common interest in the gender of genre, or what Kathleen has late called, I think more effectively, gender generics. The history of genre, feminist critics collectively agree, has failed adequately to address gender, and this has resulted in an elision which we all seek to remedy differently. I'm going to sort of fill in for you a couple of ways in which feminists have approached the issue of gender and genre and try to place each of the papers in this scheme. Feminist attention to the gender of genre first focused on ways in which women authors have been edged into marginalized genres. Are we on? Okay. As a result of their exclusion from central cultural concerns and the consequent valorization of certain high male-dominated genres. Women, these critics have shown us, became custodians of the ballad tradition, and they also felt more at home within the relatively uncodified novel form than in the Augustan high poetic movement of the 18th century. A second school of feminist genre criticism has foregrounded women authors' handling of forms or plots traditionally dominated by men, like the Gothic and the Elegy, or as Louise will demonstrate today, the Pamela plot. Louise Yellen's reading of Austen's Mansfield Park locates generic revision in Austen's subversion of the master marriage plot of Richardson's Pamela, of Richardson's novel. Third, some feminist critics account for differences between male and female appropriations of the same genre by invoking their distinct psychosexual development. Bella, for example, will take us back to maternal origins in her discussion of Krista Wolfe's autobiography. The psychological and, it turns out, autobiographical and therefore generic enterprise in Wolfe's Patterns of Childhood is a search for a voice which necessarily originates in a confrontation with the mother. A final feminist challenge to genre theory, and my own paper locates itself here, has determined that forms previously thought gender-free are in fact gender-specific by asking what a text would look like if it had been written or if it were read by a woman. Writing from the feminine in the nuptial modes of our essentially masculine Western lyric inheritance is to experience the displacement of a left-handed person trying to pick up a right-handed object. The epithalamium conventionally denies female subjectivity in love, and it idealizes an experience of love and marriage which does not correspond to female psychic organization. All three papers today second Bathsheba's opinion in Far From the Madding Crowd that, quote, it is difficult for a woman to define her feelings in language which is chiefly made by men to express theirs. The critical goal of all three projects, the three papers, has been to deconstruct the normative masculine criterion of genre that consigns feminine practice to inferior, idiosyncratic, or debased use of forms. What we hope to accomplish today in our analysis of the individual cases of autobiography, poetry, and the novel is to question a Western generic practice based on exclusion, limit, hierarchy, and taxonomy, and to lay bare the gender specificity of any genre system which pretends to rest completely upon aesthetic criteria. To confront genre with gender is to represent the very nature of representation. And all the papers, I think, will address this in turn. Louise, you start.
My paper is called, in line with the title of the session, Representing Pamela, the Subversion of the Pamela Plot in Jane Austen's Mansfield Park. For much of the first half of Samuel Richardson's Pamela, the heroine is pursued by her rakish and dissolute master, Mr. B, who plots to possess, seduce, or more bluntly, rake her, while claiming that what's at stake is love. Pamela confronts Mr. B's plot with her own plot, which is empowered and authorized by her virtue. Ultimately, Pamela's plot neutralizes the threat of rape, as the novel marries Pamela to her master. Indeed, what I am calling the Pamela plot, the novel's master plot, marries Pamela's plot to Mr. B's plot. For the novel reaches closure through a marriage that entails a series of unequal exchanges and inscribes Pamela within a social structure dominated by Mr. B. A marriage, in short, that represents or revises the patriarchal order. Thus, Pamela is responsible for the moral reform of her master and therefore the moral regeneration of the gentry, to which class her master belongs. The marriage raises her in the class hierarchy, no longer a servant, she is now a wife, while it affirms her subordination as a woman in and by the structures of bourgeois and patriarchal hegemony. No longer an agent of her own destiny, Pamela becomes her husband's almoner. That's the way he describes what her duty is. She's her almoner, dispenser of charity on his behalf. As Mr. B himself notes, The difference in their class status intensifies and reinforces the effect of sexual difference. That is, Pamela's subordination in the patriarchal institution of marriage. Pamela's social transformation is echoed by a change in the status of her discourse. Through much of the novel, Pamela is a textual producer, author of her own discourse. For those of you who haven't read the novel, it's letters that she writes, mostly to her father, but also to her mother. Through much of the novel, Pamela is a textual producer, author of her own discourse. This power, though, is always already susceptible to the authority and molestation of men. Pamela writes as a dutiful daughter, that's how she signs herself. And her text, Letters Home, is initially authorized by her father. While Mr. B's early attempts to tamper with her letters are represented as a kind of textual molestation or rape. But after the marriage, Pamela's discourse is displaced and marginalized as she is reduced to commenting in the margins of Mr. B's text, the rules of wifely conduct he composes for her. And you can see this in the book. It's written in two columns. His rules and her comments on his rules. So Pamela, the novel, dramatizes what anthropologists call female hypergamy, a structure in which women marry men whose class position is better and whose power is accordingly much greater than theirs. In Pamela, this pattern of hypergamy elaborates a bourgeois division of sexual labor, which reconstitutes patriarchal hegemony. Pamela's marriage at once elevates her into a new social sphere, exalts her as her husband's moral guide, and subjects her to his considerable power and authority. This Pamela plot lies just under the surface of a number of 19th century English novels written by women. These novels appear to revise, evade, refuse, and subvert this plot, to evoke it in order to revoke it. To give just a few examples, Charlotte Bronte's Jane Eyre marries and reforms her master, but only after he is blinded and lamed and she has acquired an independent income. Elizabeth Gaskell's Mary Barton marries not the Mr. B figure, the rich and rakish mill owner, Harry Carson, who may or may not have been trifling with Mary's affection. Rather, she marries the novel's working class, moral, and evangelical hero, Jem Wilson. And George Eliot's Maggie Tulliver, refusing the romantic plot that would annihilate her selfhood, neither marries nor reforms the decadent Stephen Guest. If the specter of Pamela is the persistent figure in the carpet in women's novels in the early and mid-19th century, the ways that women authors revise or subvert the Pamela plot indicate their dissatisfaction with its mystification of men's power, and moreover signal these women authors' resistance to the discursive fate of Pamela, which is inscription in male discourse. Nevertheless, as my cursory examples might suggest, the Pamela plot is rarely eradicated or abolished entirely from 19th century women's novels. The pressures it exerts and the traces it leaves suggest not only the power of Richardson as a patriarchal novelistic precursor, but also the ideological power of the patriarchal hegemony that the Pamela plot represents. Since my time is limited, I should like to examine the way that one novel, Austin's Mansfield Park, attempts to evade, subvert, revise, that is, represent the Pamela plot. I won't have time to point out all the echoes of Pamela in Mansfield Park, but rather will focus on the most important ways that Austin's text confronts and rewrites Richardson's. The Pamela plot, or more properly, Austin's resistance to this plot, underlies the treatment in Mansfield Park of Henry Crawford. Indeed, in the interaction of Henry's plot and Fanny Price's counterplot, Austin most clearly subverts the master plot of Pamela. Henry Crawford, handsome, clever, and rich, bored with life in the country, his vanity ungratified after the departure of the Bertram sisters from Mansfield Park, hatches a plot, as he tells his sister Mary, to make Fanny Price in love with him. This plot begins as a seductive intrigue, but is soon transformed as Henry apparently succumbs to Fanny's moral influence and decides without any prompting other than his sense of her moral and intellectual superiority and her apparent lack of interest in him that he wants to marry her. It seems then that Henry's seductive design, like that of Mr. B in Pamela, is neutralized or deflected by the moral plot of which Fanny's virtue is the agent. In other words, in Henry's apparent moral transformation, Austen evokes the Pamela plot, which represents the neutralizing or moralizing of men's power by women's virtue. But there are some crucial differences or revisions of the situation in Pamela, differences which suggest Austen's critique of Richardson. Unlike Mr. B, who was motivated by lust, Henry is motivated by a need for power, by a vanity and egoism that require that he be reflected by women at twice his natural size, as Virginia Woolf puts it in A Room of One's Own. Moreover, unlike Pamela, whose blushes reflect her attraction to Mr. B, Fanny betrays no sign of caring for Henry. Perhaps Austen demystifies the idea, a commonplace in romantic literature written by men, that seduction can ever be rendered as love. In any case, Fanny's heart is engaged elsewhere, with her cousin Edmund, whom she secretly loves. Austen's heroine resists, that is, not only on moral grounds, but also on the basis of affection secretly engaged, desires already inscribed in a heterosexual economy. But all this is Fanny's secret and ours. The hypothetical or virtual Pamela plot that the novel sets in motion is endorsed by most of its important characters. These characters then are bad or overly credulous readers of Pamela, but Austen doesn't let them see Fanny's trump card, her love of Edmund. For example, Sir Thomas Bertram envisages a marriage which balances material benefits for Fanny and her family against the moral betterment of Henry Crawford. The material advantage is important, as the Price family is a Malthusian disaster area, too many children and not enough money. Although Sir Thomas's propensity to approve of marriages that promise material without moral or spiritual benefit, such as his daughter Maria's marriage to the rich and vacuous Mr. Rushworth, discredits his authority, the scenario or plot he sketches is endorsed by virtually all the important characters in the novel, by Mary Crawford, by Edmund, by Henry himself, and even to some extent by Fanny's beloved brother William, by all that is except the grumbling Mrs. Norris and Fanny, who resists this plot, rightly as things turn out, and refuses to take responsibility for the moral improvement, to borrow one of the novel's recurrent metaphors, of Henry. What's wrong with the scenario that Sir Thomas lays out? First and most important, just as the master plot of Pamela insists on Mr. B's moral transformation, although ambiguously, Sir Thomas's plot relies on the possibility of Henry Crawford's capacity for real and enduring, that is, authentic change. This possibility, of course, turns out to be an impossibility, for the only change of which Henry is capable is superficial and transient, as Austen makes clear by presenting Henry as a consummate actor. Here it seems that Austen appropriates Henry, and I like that it's Henry, Fielding's critique of Pamela, his notion that it's easier to make good men wise than bad men good. Austen also echoes Fielding in making both a patriarch and a younger son the good men who become wise. Squire Allworthy and Tom Jones in Tom Jones, Sir Thomas Bertram and Edmund Bertram in Mansfield Park. But Austen gives Fielding's criteria of plausibility a feminine inflection, where she is particularly critical not only of the way that Henry makes his proposal of marriage, without reference to Fanny's view of the matter, but also of the fact that virtually no one in Mansfield Park takes Fanny's feelings into account in reckoning up the benefits to Fanny, but especially to Henry, of Henry's proposal. Because almost no one heeds Fanny's insistence that her feelings about Henry will not change, almost everyone furthers a plot that seeks to confine her, to borrow another recurrent metaphor, in a marriage that, like a more refined version of seduction or rape, not only subordinates and devalues, but literally discounts women's desires. Fanny is especially critical of the complicity of women, Mary Crawford, Mrs. Grant, Mrs. Norris, in this plot, invoking a female solidarity notable for its absence in Mansfield Park. Mansfield Park is a novel about sisters' allegiance to their brothers, not, as in most Austen novels, sisters' allegiance to each other. As Fanny tells Edmund in the middle of a long speech, Henry's sisters should consider me as well as him. This speech, like much of the novel, presents Fanny's point of view without the irony that usually distances Austen or her narrator from her characters. The absence of irony, here as elsewhere, gives a kind of tacit credence to Fanny's view. Indeed, one of the hardest things to take about Fanny is the fact that she is always right. Fanny's rightness, moreover, encompasses a secular sense of self, a sense of her rights and prerogatives as a woman. These include, as with Pamela, the right to love. and a specifically Protestant sense of moral autonomy or conscience. It's the latter that makes Fanny respond to Henry's remark that her judgment is his rule of right by saying, "We have all a better guide in ourselves if we attend to it than any other person can be." Fanny's Protestant virtue, along with her sense of her prerogatives as a woman, makes her refuse responsibility for Henry's moral transformation. This refusal is an aspect of the stillness, the passivity or tranquility, that distinguishes Fanny not only from Pamela, who contemplates suicide, actually tries to escape from confinement in Bee Hall, and writes about her experience in a revision of Psalm 137, distinguishes Fanny not only from Pamela, but also from Austen's other female protagonists. Beset by Henry and by all the forces he marshals on his own behalf, an alignment or alliance that defines the power structure in Mansfield Park, Fanny can do little more than resist, but resistance, as one critic observes, is likely to be misconstrued in accord with the codes of propriety as acquiescence of a sort. Fanny's dilemma is epitomized in chapter 35, where Henry reads Shakespeare in an attempt to extort, and that's the novel's word, to extort from Fanny a word of praise. In fact, Henry reads all the parts in Henry VIII with equal charm, facility, and verve. He's most authentic when he's acting. In keeping silent, Fanny not only refuses the role of moral guide which Henry tries to foist on her, she also refuses the role that Pamela adopts as commentator on male discourse, or in this case, performance. Fanny meets Henry's further attack, his provocative attempt to get her to move, speak, act, interpret, with a motionlessness broken only by an involuntary shake of the head, which he takes the liberty of interpreting, again attempting to provoke her to interpret or moralize him. As this scene is written, it appears that the only way that Fanny can evade Henry's plot is by an absolute stillness, a motionlessness so complete as to be tantamount to death. And I thought I would read you some of this. The context here is that sitting around the way characters in Austen novels always do. Edmund says, "Let's read some Shakespeare," and Henry reads all the parts in Henry VIII. And then they get to talking about giving sermons, because Edmund is a parson. He's just become a parson. I lost my page. And Fanny is the only one in the novel who takes very seriously Edmund's vocation as a clergyman. "Our liturgy," observed Crawford, "has beauties which not even a careless, slovenly style of reading can destroy. But it has also redundancies and repetitions which require good reading not to be felt. For myself, at least, I must confess, being not always so attentive as I ought to be," here was a glance at Fanny, "that 19 times out of 20, I am thinking how such a prayer ought to be read, and longing to have it read myself. Did you speak?" Stepping eagerly to Fanny and addressing her in a softened voice, and upon her saying no, he added, "Are you sure you did not speak? I saw your lips move. I fancied you might be going to tell me I ought to be more attentive and not allow my thoughts to wander. Are not you going to tell me so?" "No, indeed. You know your duty too well for me to even supposing." That's the way Bleak House ends, by the way. The last words of Bleak House are "even supposing." She stopped, felt herself getting into a puzzle, and could not be prevailed on to add another word, not by dint of several minutes of supplication and waiting. He then returned to his former station and went on as if there had been no such tender interruption. "A sermon well delivered is more uncommon even than prayers well read. A sermon good in itself is no rare thing. It is more difficult to speak well than to compose well. That is, the rules and tricks of composition are oftener an object of study. A thoroughly good sermon, thoroughly well delivered, is a capital gratification. I can never hear such a one without the greatest admiration and respect, and more than half a mind to take orders and preach myself. There is something in the eloquence of the pulpit, when it is really eloquence, which is entitled to the highest praise and honor. The preacher who can touch and affect such an heterogeneous mass of hearers on subjects limited and long-worn threadbare in all common hands, who can say anything new or striking, anything that rouses the attention without offending the taste or wearing out the feelings of his hearers, is a man whom one could not, in his public capacity, honor enough. I should like to be such a man." Edmund laughed. I should indeed. I never listened to a distinguished preacher in my life without a sort of envy. But then I must have a London audience. I could not preach but to the educated, to those who were capable of estimating my composition. And I do not know that I should be fond of preaching often. Now and then, perhaps, once or twice in the spring, after being anxiously expected for half a dozen Sundays together. But not for a constancy. It would not do for a constancy. Here, Fanny, who could not but listen, involuntarily shook her head, and Crawford was instantly by her side again, entreating to know her meaning. And as Edmund perceived by his drawing in a chair and sitting down close by her, that it was to be a very thorough attack, that looks and undertones were to be well tried, he sank as quietly as possible into a corner, turned his back, and took up a newspaper, very sincerely wishing that dear little Fanny might be persuaded into explaining away that shake of the head to the satisfaction of her ardent lover, and as earnestly trying to bury every sound of the business from himself in murmurs of his own over the various advertisements of a most desirable estate in South Wales to parents and guardians and a capital seasoned hunter. Austin rescues Fanny from this novelistic cul-de-sac by making Henry undergo a moral lapse, or more precisely, a relapse. While presumably waiting for Fanny to say yes, Henry seduces Maria Rushworth and proves that Fanny was right in judging him not amenable to improvement. With this one broad stroke, it seems, Austin topples the Pamela plot, which cannot be enacted without the authentic moral reform of the male protagonist. Yet Austin does not and cannot dispatch the Pamela plot completely. At the end of the novel, after Henry's seduction of Maria makes it impossible for Edmund any longer to consider marrying Mary Crawford, Edmund comes to see that Fanny was right in her views of the Crawfords, and a wiser man falls in love with Fanny and marries her. This marriage, of course, raises her position in the class structure, although not to the same extent as would marriage to Henry, or to Edmund's older brother, Tom, the heir to the Bertram estate. In Mansfield Park, Austin does not so much obliterate the Pamela plot as modify it, temper its excesses, or re-present it. Fanny is responsible for the moral improvement, although not the reform or transformation per se of her husband, and for the moral and consequently the material regeneration of the entire Bertram family. Austin sidesteps an obvious parallel with Pamela, for in accord with her expressed theme, ordination, she marries Fanny not to Tom Bertram, but to Edmund, the second son, consequently minimizing the difference in power between Fanny and her husband. Yet what is ordained in this novel of ordination? How and by whom is the order made? Clearly, it is Fanny who ordains or underwrites the morally transformed social, that is, patriarchal order in and of Mansfield Park, the place. And it is in and by this morally regenerated order that Fanny's desire is appropriated and itself transformed. But the inscription of Fanny's desire in the newly renovated order of Mansfield Park suggests not simply the power of patriarchy as a social order, or of the gentry as a class, for these in any case are dying or changing, as is evident in the various internal and external threats to Mansfield Park in the novel. More important, Mansfield Park, the novel, not the place, dramatizes the ideological power of patriarchy, which inflects women's texts and forbids the articulation of desire outside the structures of patriarchal hegemony, seduction, romance, marriage. In Mansfield Park, the novel, not the place, the only way out of the novel's cul-de-sac of stillness unto death is Fanny's marriage, a marriage that, while it encodes Austin's resistance to or evasion of the master plot of Pamela, also represents what Pamela represents, the continuing hegemony of patriarchy. It is not until later in the 19th century that life without marriage becomes imaginable in British women's novels. But that's another story.
My talk is entitled The Quest for a Crystal Ball, her autobiographical project. On November 3rd, 1972, celebrated East German writer Christa Wolf, author of The Quest for Crystal Tea, No Place on Earth, and Cassandra, described the new beginning of an anguishing but absolutely necessary personal project, the resurrection of her childhood memories in Nazi Germany. In actuality, the autobiographical project had already begun, before the inscribed textual point of departure. 16 months earlier, in the summer of 1971, she returned for a weekend, accompanied by her husband, brother, and teenage daughter, to the hometown she had not seen since 1945. Upon the arrival of the victorious Allies, she had been evacuated, along with some, but not all, members of her family. And this is a quote. "A girl, Nellie, stuffed and stiff in double and triple layers of clothes, stuffed with history, if these words mean anything, is grabbed up on the truck in order to leave her childhood abode, so deeply anchored in German poetry and the German soul." As the above quote indicates, Wolfe feels that a profound lack of integrity is masked by the generic use of the autobiographical I, and she refers to herself in two persons. When speaking to and of Krista Wolfe, recent tourist to a strange land and contemporary author of this text, the narrator uses second person you. When referring to herself as child, she uses third person, naming her Nellie. Wolfe presents the ambiguous relation between self-referentiality and textuality in autobiography as the philosophical dilemma of whether to remain speechless or to live in the third person. The first, she says, is impossible. The second, strange. This form of internal distancing underscores her problematic position in the text. In linguistic terms, I is a shifter. It reflects the figure of enunciation only in the act of enunciation and carries no transcendent status. In autobiographical terms, I is a fictional construct, a stranger, always a displaced person. The autobiography structure appears to mine the account of the journey back to Lonsberg, now a part of Poland, which serves as a catalyst for rendering the process of Wolfe writing the book about that experience. Returning to the source, to that childhood abode, is always fraught with poignancy, rage, and regret, the retrospective movement upon which every autobiographical quest is based, is blocked at many points along the way. In this case, however, the act of striving to penetrate the inscrutability of one's past is even more difficult than most. Militating against Wolfe's expressed desire for self-understanding is the deliberately cultivated collective amnesia of post-war Germany. Inextricably tied to her own sense of fractured identity is a crucial point of reference that she spent her girlhood as an ambivalent but successful member of the Hitler Youth. And the first passage that we're going to look at is the one that has a big six on it. Okay. I'm going to read to you. "It is the person who remembers, not memory. The person who has learned to see himself not as I, but as you. A stylistic particularity such as this can't be arbitrary or accidental. The sudden switch from the third to the second person, which only seems to be closer to the first, the morning after a vivid dream. It took place a long time after the summer visit to L, in a town which wasn't your hometown, but was supposed to be your hometown, as you knew it in your dream. You find the town untidy, in a state of turmoil. You buy something, carried in a shopping net, beautiful golden apples. A man comes and accuses you of having appropriated something that has been entrusted to you for safekeeping. You affirm that you deposited it elsewhere. The man is not unfriendly. He doesn't wish to humiliate you. He has blonde, wavy hair. You can't hold it against him that he is suspicious of you. You understand. It's his job. Together you walk through an unkempt wood. A policeman with a white cap is brutally roughing up an old woman who has supposedly stolen some wood, a single stick. Your escort informs you that even a petty theft must be duly and severely punished. How much more so your serious embezzlement? You nod. You lead him into a large, square gray house at the edge of the sparse, ravaged wood. That's how the woods looked at the end of the war. In a kind of hallway, a woman is talking to another at the top of her voice about everyday things. She categorically denies any knowledge of the object you're asking about. You desperately insist that you left it here for safekeeping. She finally points to a net which holds a few wrapped little packages and a beautiful, slender bottle. That's it, you call out, infinitely relieved, although deep down you know that you've been looking for something else. Your escort, too, is satisfied. He holds the bottle up against the light. It is pale green and transparent, painfully pure and flawless.
You see, the escort says, this was a true memory lapse. You're happy to have an explanation for everything, one that exonerates you and with which you can agree. The ravine. This hillside, the grassy, lizard-populated slope, was once Nellie's playground. She had a tendency to hide herself, to shun places in which one would hope or fear to find her. One could hope or fear to find her. Now you realize why you hadn't been eager to come here for 26 years. Unspoken and unadmitted excuses, the loss of your homeland, the possible pain of recognition, were no longer valid. You shied away from an encounter that would be unavoidable. Perhaps those who haven't experienced it should not be envied. A feeling of embarrassment in front of a child. You had worked your way through to this spot, up to this house, not in a straight line, but in a seemingly aimless zigzag course, in order to get the feel of the child, possibly with the help of a memory exposed to the impact of details, one that begins to yield items of astounding insignificance. That's when you had to realize that you could never again be her ally, that you were an intruding stranger pursuing not a more or less well-marked trail, but actually the child herself, her innermost secret that concerned no one else. All right, well, you can see, something I'm going to bring up later, that she uses dreams very effectively. Sometimes there's no other way for her to call up a memory. Either it's deliberately repressed or it's so deeply submerged, so deeply. What she's saying is that this form of self-betrayal is a forbidden act, because not only does she work against herself by doing that, but she will, of course, implicate somebody else or something else, because it's not only her secret that she's worried about unearthing, but the secret that all of Germany harbors and that she's complicit in, she feels. And so her guilt is always projected onto Germany's self-protective instincts. So her worry is, should she go against, in a sense, the collective good in order to do this absolutely necessary thing for herself, and by extension, do what needs to be done for Germany, too. But she knows that this is a transgression. So, of course, in the dream, she starts off carrying beautiful golden apples because she wants to believe that it's a benign act and an important act and a beautiful act to go back to your childhood. But then, of course, she's immediately accused of something. And in this totalitarian world, sort of cock-the-like world, you're always guilty no matter what it is. So that the woman, the poor old woman who steals a stick, and she who has, in a sense, who harbors secrets against the state, are equally guilty. And as I say, you're always already guilty. So whether you admit it or not, or whether you are able to discover or name the object, doesn't really matter, because the object is beside the point. And when she says, you know, that he has blonde wavy hair, of course she's invoking the Aryan model. She can't hold it against him that he's doing his job, you know, the old thing, I was just following orders. The levels of guilt and complicity are so inextricably intertwined that she can't really separate herself from the person who interrogates her, in a sense, because she projects so much onto him. What I think is wonderful about Wolf is, as much as she tries to justify what she does, she's so relentlessly honest, and she has such an acute sense of irony that she catches herself before she does it, and after you have already done it, you say, oh no, you can't do that to yourself, but she knows when she's doing it, and she really confronts it straight on. So the thing that she's most concerned about, at least in this passage, is what is her relationship to this other part of herself that's called Nellie? Is it an honest trip to take? What really are her deepest intentions? What is her goal? What does she really want to do with it? What is she really after? And why is it so dangerous, of course, to do this? So I say the book, in a manner of speaking, begins again and again, because she's constantly questioning what she's doing and how she goes about it. It's a methodological check, in fact. She integrates her fearful ambivalence about writing into the fabric of the narrative, arguably making her revolt against what she calls the limits of the expressible, the text's most compelling and unresolved theme. As many autobiographical narratives are, Patterns of Childhood is a meditation on the nature of memory, guilt, truth, history, and loss, But most of all, it is a relentless interrogation, with all the political connotations of that word left intact, of language, as it is intrinsically related to the concept of the subject or self and the ways in which its psychic and moral boundaries are most elusive to itself. And this is another quotation. The lines, life lines, work lines, will not cross at the point which used to be called truth. You know only too well what you're permitted to find difficult and what not, what you're permitted to know and what not, what must be talked about and in what tone, and what must be buried in silence forever. You wouldn't be able to write the book, and you knew why. Why does Wolf say that she cannot write this book? The tension between the overwhelming compulsion to address and the equally strong internal resistance against disclosure pivots on the dangers associated with the nature of the autobiographical enterprise itself. For the female autobiographer, this enterprise represents, in a distinctive way, the psychoanalytic search for origins. This is, by definition, a search for maternal origins, and for that part of the self, however diffused, that is most intimately related to language. It takes Wolf two-thirds of the way through what could hardly be characterized as a straightforward, continuous narrative to say that her mother did not climb on the truck that day with the rest of the family, that she stayed behind for no plausible reason, and that for all intents and purposes, from the child's perspective at least, she abandoned her at the most crucial of moments. None of Nellie's attempts to rewrite the story of that traumatic event worked, not because memory fails, but because for Wolf, language is inadequate to perform such a transfigurative task. In a large sense, however, we can say that the entire autobiography represents an effort to understand and reconstruct, restore and reclaim the mother's message in her absence. To do this, Wolf and all female autobiographers must distinguish and decode the many modes of discourse, familial, political, psychosexual, historical, and social, that surround the mother as a figure and keep her powerful, yet more inaccessible than ever. The passage I would like to look at now is one of the earliest invocations and evocations of the absent mother in the text. It represents a summons, a form of address, a conjuring up, if you will, and a challenge, with all the attendant psychological complexities that such an act entails and that writing crystallizes. It begins as an urgent but provisional attempt to theoretically define memory and to locate its origins. But like all of the modes of discourse examined here, it soon turns into something else. A dream memory. Wolf often relies on dreams as the crucial mode of access to memories that remain beyond the limits of ordinary speech or conscious experience. What cannot be thought or articulated in waking hours is most often symbolically enacted in dream. And it is here that we see Wolf's extraordinary interpretive imagination at its best. Okay, I'm going to go about a third of the way down the page. Memory. According to today's interpretation, the preservation of previous experience and the faculty to do so. Not an organ then, but a process and the capacity for carrying it out, expressed in one word. An unused memory gets lost, ceases to exist, dissolves into nothing, an alarming thought. Consequently, the faculty to preserve, to remember, must be developed. Before your inner eye, ghostly arms emerge, groping about in a dense fog, aimlessly. You have no way of penetrating all the layers systematically. You're wasting your energy. It's no more result in fatigue when you go and take a nap in broad daylight. Just then, your mother comes in, even though she's dead, and sits down in the big room, something you'd always secretly wanted. A whole family is gathered, the living and the dead. You alone are able to tell one from the other, but you have to go to the kitchen to wash all those dishes. The sun is shining through the kitchen window, but you feel sad, and you lock the door so that no one can come in and help you. Suddenly, a shock that penetrates even the roots of your hair. In the big room on the table lies the manuscript, with, on the first page, only one word, Mother, in large letters. She'll read it, guess your purpose, and feel hurt. Well, you can sort of close to look at this. It's a hard passage to talk about. She's exhausted, as you can imagine, from physically and mentally exhausted from pursuing this project, unless she's so compelled to do it that all the resistances along the way only further compel her. And again, you have those layers of complicity and guilt. And the guilt is now, at least in this passage, not directed against this collective memory, this state of which she's a part, this, in a sense, this destiny that she chose not to follow, but against betraying her mother, who is, I would say, is also a part of herself. She knows she doesn't understand why her mother left her, and her mother never explained it, and so this effort to keep trying to find out why is it that she left her is a part of this whole venture. So when she launches into this discursion, in a sense, about what memory is, and she does this several times in the text, she comes up with many different definitions. Of course, none of them, no matter how, sort of lexically correct, semantically correct, come up to what memory is, because memory is something that none of us understand. She has to find an escape route, and she has to find another mode of language that will enable her to get at the thing that she needs to get at, but she's most afraid of. And at that point, of course, things start to get distorted. So she talks about her inner eye, ghostly arms, groping about in a dense fog, aimlessly. And in fact, she's not aimless at all, she's quite directed, but the direction that she's going is the thing that she's most afraid of. And if any of you have had to deal with a blank manuscript, you can imagine how many excuses you need to come up with in order to avoid doing the thing that you have to do. So she says, I'll just go take a nap. I'm so exhausted, I'll take a nap. But of course, she goes and takes a nap, and what happens? The very thing that she's most worried about happening, but she most wants that to happen. She wants to meet her mother. She wants to confront her, challenge her, and she has to do it in the most mediated way possible, which is not to tell her directly, but of course, to leave it as a text so that her mother can read it rather than read her. All she has to do is leave that one word, mother, and that will say it all. In perfect psychoanalytic terms, too, if you think about what happens at the end of The White Hotel, if you could bring your therapy around full circle, what you would do is bring back from the dead all those people that you can no longer talk to. So that's what she does. She brings her back, has this whole scene, every family member, both alive and dead. Only she can interpret who they are and what they're capable of doing for her. And the person who's most important in that scene, of course, is the mother. And then how does she end the passage? By saying, she'll read it, guess your purpose, and feel hurt. Now, what is her purpose? She's not sure, but she knows that her mother would misunderstand it, as she has misunderstood her mother. Of course, that's the implicit dialogue that takes place. There are many dream narratives in this text whose dominant images have to do with silence, paralysis, mutation, amputation, represented in the loss of a writing hand, a man without a mouth, or a scream that no one hears, scenes of torture, neglect, complicity, impotence, deception, and death. Who is the agent and who is the victim? If the mother is the transmitter of cultural values in a culture that wishes to pretend it has no recent history, then what is the daughter's place in that continuum? Where to start? What do I know? How do I know what I know? How to say it? These are the questions that Krista Wolf's Patterns of Childhood strives with relentless honesty and irony to formulate. That there are no direct answers is only further evidence that the autobiographer who pretends to speak from a position of ontological and epistemological certitude is acting out of fiction. Certainly for some, such ambiguity jeopardizes or even undermines totally autobiography's claims for credibility within a literary tradition that has long depended on the availability of generic distinctions. But as is usually the case, there is more at stake in the evaluation and classification of generic forms of content than has generally been conceded. The difficulty of saying I may be the most fascinating problem in the study of autobiography, that the exciting convergence of feminist theory, psychoanalysis, and post-structuralism has helped make this explicit, puts women's autobiography where it belongs, in the first place. Thank you.
I think we can listen to one more paper? Okay, this is the last one, and then I think we're going to try to open up the discussion. I think in some ways my paper will be a footnote to the previous two, because my paper has the same obsessions, mothers and marriage. So it will answer, I think, both of these. My paper is called Songs from the Bride, with the from in editorial brackets. It's usually Songs for the Bride. When Women Poets Write Epithalamia. The traditional preoccupations of Western genre theory since antiquity have been the establishment of limits, the drawing of exclusionary lines, the fascistic protection of idealized generic purity. And poetic borders have been policed even more stringently than those of prose by homo, properly understood man, taxonomicus. In fact, women writers able to make themselves at home in the house of prose still found themselves exiles when it came time to poetic genres. Barred access to highly codified forms like the sonnet, the elegy, the epithalamium, women poets have had necessarily to refuse, resist, and reconstruct our Western lyric inheritance. Ever since Sappho's poignant epithalamia included an elegy for a rent hymen, am I still sad because of my lost maidenhood, women poets have written differently of marriage, resisting by an array of strategies the conventional generic treatment of that ceremony. Songs from the Bride, as the editorial insertion in my title makes clear, will examine a poetic genre that conventionally sings songs for and of the bride rather than by her. That is, the traditional epithalamium centers the feminine as object of male gaze and poetic celebration, effectively denying her access to subjectivity and voice. How, in fact, does a woman poet take on a genre designed to idealize her? How can she speak in a mode which depends upon her as object? In the time allotted to me, I will attempt three things more briefly than I really can, sacrificing depth to what I hope will be a useful breadth of coverage in this case. First, I plan to address the genre of the epithalamium as gender-specific, to the masculine, that is. Second, I will present women poets' efforts to remake the genre in their own image as a nuptial poetics of rape, rupture, and loss, itself a protest, both thematic and formal, against inscription into the patriarchal symbolic. Last, I will introduce a heartening array of contemporary poems which suggest the possibility for a new female subjectivity of the erotic, a new poetics of marriage, new songs from the bride. The classical epithalamium was traditionally a song sung outside, epi, the nuptial chamber, thalamos, epithalamium, upon the consummation of the marriage union in celebration of conquest won. By the time of Catullus, any wedding song received a generic label. The conventional epithalamium runs the length of the day during the spring or summer season. It describes marriage preparations and participants. It features a bride virtually definable by her virginity. It projects a fiction of erotic union and sensual plenitude expressed in natural images, particularly the gender-determined pair of dependent vine and elm. The tone may often be didactic, as the genre's function is largely to exalt the patriarchal institution of matrimony. It most often bears the overlay of allegorical significance or cosmological symbolism. The marriage ritual, as male authors eternally exploit it, symbolizes in a series of parallel relations the wedding of man to woman, king to subjects, church to state, heaven to earth, even as it seems to deny hierarchy in its transcendental celebration of unity and order. Because epithalamium reaffirms social hierarchy, and along with it, patriarchal hegemony, we did not write these papers together, it may have found its truest home in the weddings which close plays like Shakespeare's As You Like It, and, with reservations, certain of Jane Austen's novels. The entire movement of the epithalamium as genre is toward conservative resolution and closure. Women poets from the first strain against the traditional epithalamium because the genre by definition objectifies the feminine. Even in Spenser's canonical epithalamium, which is perhaps the most benign and beautiful nuptial poem in the whole tradition, the paradigmatic arrangement of Orphic courtier bridegroom, master at singing and master in the bridal chamber as well, and passive, voiceless, decked, and wedded bride inscribes a ceremony with familiar ritual overtones, an initiation ceremony which imprisons the bride ever more firmly in anonymity, a rite which makes of her, in short, a cipher. While ostensibly singing for the bride, male poet celebrants tend, in fact, to ally her distinct psychological experience of marriage, often an occasion of separation and mourning, which women poets record eloquently and poignantly. Instead, the epithalamium is often co-opted, as in Spencer's epithalamium, to stage an Orphic marriage of poet and court, that is, an occasion poem which ostensibly records personal arrangements doubles as a vocational pronouncement. Male poets, even at their most personal, tend to use the epithalamium, which flowered in the Renaissance as a kind of occasion poem, as a poetic opportunity for solicitation or recognition of patronage. God, politics, and poetics are its proper province. Finally, the traditional epithalamium, from the rhetorical epithalamia of the late Middle Ages to some recent poems of state, always concludes transcendentally, a gesture replete with significances which women poets, in their appropriation of the genre, pointedly resist. How love achieves literary representation depends as thoroughly in poetry as in narrative upon who is telling the story. Characteristic of the early epithalamium, for example, are a particular mocking, even sadistic tone, and a profusion of ribald jokes and sexual taunts which, addressed to the bridegroom, may correspond to and even functionally allay the masculine sexual anxiety aroused by the wedding night. We might note as well, as evidence for the gender specificity of literary conventions, the traditional separation between male erotic and amatory verse, nuptial verse. A third male engendered convention of the traditional wedding poem is the blazon or catalog of the bride's physical attributes. These will sound familiar. These ideal and unreal comparisons, hair like gold, eyes like sapphires, lips like rubies, etc., so disembodied the bride that Shakespeare himself was compelled to write a parody in My Mistress Eyes Are Nothing Like the Sun. Generally, however, the conventional epithalamium welcomes marriage from the masculine point of view as a handing over of title, an acquisition of stature and efficacy. The project is governed thoroughly by a fulsome idealization of the bride and a simultaneous devaluation of her. When John Donne ends every stanza of his Lincoln's Inn epithalamium with "Today put on perfection and a woman's name," he exalts, of course, the virgin's spotlessness, but he also hints bodily at the impending male perfection of woman by the act of insemination and suggests the dependence of woman's identity upon a rite of passage into heterosexuality. When Richard Crashaw, in his epithalamium, speaks of the rich loss in exchange of dying maid for dawning wife, he puns brilliantly upon the little death of orgasm dependent upon the loss of innocence, but he does not do so from the frightened anticipatory vantage point of someone about to lose hers. Woman's alternate experience of love relations, as I have begun to suggest, is in some ways the counterpart of men's, and the literary evidence of that difference is itself unsettlingly polarized. Woman's sexual experience has largely, and to some soberingly, determined the forms of her textual expression. In a manner that bears directly upon the epithalamium, fear of defloration and all that it implies for female identity directs the shapes of women's self-conception as creative artists as much as it determines the forms of their writing. Arising from an alternate set of internalized relations, women's epithalamia bespeak a singularly feminine view of marriage as a rite of wounding or violation, as an occasion for mourning broken bonds with female companions and mothers, and, when celebratory, as an experience of love more fluid, realistic, and evolving, that is to say, less symbolic, platonized, and transcendental than that manifest in the epithalamia of their male counterparts. Rather than lifting the epithalamium into registers other than the personal and amatory, the transcendental, female epithalamists use the genre to dramatize private rites about which they are infinitely more ambivalent. The tones of women's epithalamia are different, as early as Sappho, when women poets write about impending loss of virginity. In fragment 34, when a bride asks sadly, "Virginity, oh my virginity, where will you go when I lose you?" a second voice, perhaps the hymen itself, responds, "I'm off to a place I shall never come back from, dear bride, I shall never come back to you, never." Most poignant, perhaps, is Sappho's elegy for a lost maidenhead. "Like a hyacinth in the mountains, trampled by shepherds until only a purple stain remains upon the ground." Emily Dickinson makes the same equation that marriage is a kind of death to the virgin in her born, bridled, shrouded, "In a day, is this the way?" The locus classicus of the marriage as death topos, and indispensable to a discussion of women's epithalamia, is the Persephone myth, dating at least as far back in its literary representation as the Homerican to Demeter. In this earliest of dramas of female identity, marriage not only takes the form of rape, it is crucially mediated through the maternal relationship. The poem begins in an all-female world where Persephone enjoys an innocent virgin state of near fusion with the mother. The harmony of this pre-Oedipal paradise is then shattered by the intrusion of the male in the form of an abductor, because the prerogative to give Persephone over in marriage remains paternal. Zeus awards her an object of exchange to his brother, the god of the underworld. And Persephone participates in the abduction to the extent that she reaches eagerly for the Narcissus lure, associated with death, phallic power, and sexuality. Marriage thus resonates doubly for Persephone, and I might add for women generally. It facilitates separation from the mother, but it necessitates excruciating loss of a sustained bond. The poem ends with Persephone's rapturous return to her origin, the mother, by means of an uneasy solution, spending a third of the year with the rapist lover, husband, and two-thirds of the year with the mother lover, in a kind of divided life illuminated by Nancy Chodorow's notion of woman's suspension in a bisexual triangle between mother and father, between homoeroticism and heterosexuality. Marriage cannot be greeted other than ambivalently in terms of the female maturational pattern elaborated in this poem and given recent theoretical grounding by Chodorow. Hence we get the repeated effect of a pattern in a series of contemporary poems centering upon the Persephone-Demeter myth. And Sylvia Plath's Two Sisters of Persephone doubles the divided daughter into a pair of twins, one a sensualist and one a mathematician. The first becomes, predictably, the male son's bride, grows quick with seed, and bears a king. The second, resistant to absorption, a wry virgin to the last, goes graveward with flesh-laid waste, worm-husbanded, yet no woman. To resist marriage is to take the veil or its equivalent, to flee femininity as culturally constructed and approved. But the most arresting contemporary poetic treatment of the daughter's division between two loves is that of Enid Dane and Persephone. You have that poem in front of you if you want to follow. The first part of this poem sets up the daughter's desire. It's the second page. The first part of this poem sets up the daughter's desire to, quote, spend my life in her kitchen, quietly watching her capable fingers build fires, strip corn ears, crack warm eggs against a blue bowl. I wanted to be a part of that room, to remain within the contours, as the assonance no doubt suggests, of that womb. In part two of this poem, and I'm skipping over the first part for time's sake here, in part two of this poem, Persephone considers marriage. I only went on that blind date to please her. The man was too old, his fingers were stained, yet he promised to bring me home safely. Instead, he brought me down here. The only good thing about this place is it's too boggy dark to see what he looks like. He says, you're my little girl now. He smells like old clothes. His body sprouts fingers fatter than carrots. They grip me knobbly. He rocks up and down like a leaky old boat rocks on the ocean. He shipwrecks inside me every night. When he kisses me later, I call him Mama. Even when women's poems about marriage do not explicitly name the mother as first lover, as Dame's does, they inevitably mourn the rupture of significant female bonds. And I don't have time to go over the first poem in that thing, but I hope you'll look at it later. It's a poem from a 3rd century BC Hellenistic poet named Erinna, and it'll give you a sense of this contrast between women's time and marriage, between the pre-Oedipal and the post-nuptial. Other epithalamia horrify in their systematic inversion of hymeneal imagery, their deliberate exchange of nuptial fire for funeral pyre. Emily Dickinson's This Chasm Sweet Upon My Life is not a recognizable epithalamium by any stretch of the imagination, but the poet who envisioned a funeral in her brain was more than capable of imagining a scenario like the following. In this poem, you don't have this one if you're looking for it. I'm just going to run it down. In this poem, the saccharine tone the addresses to sweet and darling belie the necessary truth of this bride's experience. In this black marriage, she is the, quote, favorite of doom, constrained by a relationship that contains her like a tomb. The poem ends with a terrible conceit of pregnancy, a parody of the expected conclusion of the traditional epithalamium. This bride, driven to suicide, bears her own burial, being about, as if it were a child. In a similar anti-epithalamic vein, the poet H.D. has written a dark, dignified, and solemn mass called Hymen, dramatizing by means of an austere procession the inexorable process of girlhood into wifedom. Finally, a number of female epithalamia are fueled, arbiters of purity of genre would insist informed, by rage. Plath's Purga is a poem of bridal greeting in which a veiled bride, revolving in her sheaf of impossibles, hears her bridegroom arrive and suddenly unlooses from the small, jeweled doll he guards like a heart, the lioness, the shriek in the bath, the cloak of holes. Eve metamorphoses in this poem into Clytemnestra, raising her knife to cut the murderous husband down. Women's epithalamia not only give voice to suppressed evidence of women's experience in love and marriage, they also sharply critique the implied ideology of the traditional epithalamia. Women poets refuse transcendence and the disembodiment assigned to them in nuptial poetry by catalog or idealization by writing poems which locate their experience of marriage in the body. The striking shared feature of this representation is its different emphasis. In their citing of women's experience of love and marriage in the material body, women poets remind us that in their view, love has a body, and in its vulnerability to assault, that body is female. But women poets do more than resist or subvert a genre that circumscribes them. They also reconstruct uninhabitable forms by imagining new or alternative nuptial scenarios. In contemporary women's poetry, we find a range of poems which reach cheerfully, at last, after new sexual configurations, sound hitherto unheard erotic melodies, claim a subjectivity for the woman as lover in command of her own songs, bespeak equally female but less violent fantasies of love, imagine the possibility of marriage as a mutuality. H.D.'s Psyche caps the entire series of modern Persephone poems discussed above by imagining nuptials other than those imposed upon the violated Persephone. Replacing that daughter's tale of a death wedding with Psyche's story of empowerment, H.D. celebrates Psyche's ability to meet ecstasy actively and to inspire caring in Eros himself. Were Persephone to learn from Psyche's experience of love, even men like Hades might be brought back from the figurative dead. If I could sing this god, Persephone in hell would lift her quivering lids and smile. The mysteries hid, escaping all the years, alike both priest and cynic would smilingly prevail. Dead men would start and move toward me to learn love. Romanian poet Maria Banas's Wedding also begins in darkness. You have that one, that's the third poem. In the nuptial room, there was a black cosmic cold. Undress, I told him, make me warm. But it ends with a vision of the nurturing sky, a milky streak of cloud. To make the kind of bond his bride seeks in bed, however, the bridegroom in this poem has to shed the masculine armor, the violent machinery of his entire civilization. The bride's undressing of this technological man, whose heart finally doesn't grate, clank, or explode, but instead throbs humanly, makes for an odd but surprisingly warming epithalamia. Banas's solution is a brilliant recasting of a familiar convention. The blazon to the bride's idealized attributes is replaced by a different sort of catalog, one which strips this bridegroom naked, freeing him to love. First he unscrewed his head, it grated like Saturn trying to escape the vice of his rings, or like the stopper of a bottle when it shrieks against the glass throat. He unscrewed his right arm with its bullet threading. He unscrewed his left arm like a supple metallic rocket. He unscrewed his artificial right leg, swearing like a truck driver at a hacking engine. He unscrewed his artificial left leg, and iron groaned against iron like a boiler room. At the close of this poem, in a quietly apocalyptic vision, nature replaces the disappointment.